ॐ सहनावतु सहनौभुनक्तु सहवीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः।
I thought we'd just do some psychology. I thought I'd start by looking at some of these questions, and you can keep putting questions in, but also as things come to mind that I think would be helpful, I'll just, that'll be like my question that I'm answering, because I think it'll be something useful. I thought we'd do this for maybe a few days, and then I was looking at different texts that we could easily do in the period of time that we have left. And I think this Panchadashi chapter 10 would be really a beautiful way to sum up, just bring everything together in a nice way. So we can't very, we need something that's maybe about 30 verses or so. How does that sound? Okay, good. What we have here. Fears. Fear not to be liked, wanted, respected, loved. Fear not to be good enough. Fear of rejections. The psychological aspect of fear is the sense of separation and duality. Yeah. Some of these, the fears that are listed here, Heinz Kohut, one of the kind of a well-respected psychologist who has his own psychology, called self-psychology, would kind of give you just about the same list in terms of fear to not be liked or loved or wanted or respected. That's the kind of an underlying fear that most people have, and that's because often thought of the reason for that is because in the family life when you're a child, they're just, the child didn't get just filled up with love. You know, they have to be just totally filled up with love, and then that becomes the introjected. So it even loses this subject-object relationship. It just becomes part of the structure of the very psyche of being loved. And so then, if that hasn't happened, and especially in this era, and it gets more and more intense because of how hard it is to make enough money and make a living, and also just because of the different desires of both men and women wanting to work, wanting to accomplish something, not just stay home. It's not enough in this era. It's not satisfying enough. And so it's hard to totally give the amount of attention that a child may need, you know. And even in well-intentioned parents, you know, who are kind, love their child, they don't hurt their child in any way, but nevertheless, there can be distractions in terms of the workplace and the amount of time that you can actually spend with your child. Grandparents are great for that. You know, the family, the grandparents are family. And so the grandparents can do a lot in terms of filling up that love. And the other thing is, in my experience, grandparents want nothing more than to be with their grandchildren. You know, they just wait. And they don't want to push on the parents, you know, try to hog the little baby, but they really want that baby. I know from my sister how much with her grandchildren. She would take them all of the time. She would like to be the primary babysitter for so she can be with them. So grandparents, you know, and family members, because we used to have joint families, extended families, and then that child was passed around. Always somebody was there to play with it, you know, and to hold it and to comfort it. And to, so it's always being filled with love and attention. And so it's difficult for those of us who are parents that have a nuclear family only, without this kind of extended, they're not the extended family that can offer so much. It can be hard for the parents to be able to really fill up the child with as much attention that it needs. And so if it's not filled up, I would say you can't even think about, you know, doing everything perfectly. It's not in the cards. So you have to always think, as Winnicott, another famous psychologist, whom I really love him. He's wonderful. In that all of us can have different psychologists that really ring, you know, that are meaningful. He's one of them for me. He's the one that says, you know, you have to be a good enough mother, good enough father. And then even the little areas where there's lacking, that's also useful because the child gets some tension and then it gets resolved, you know. It doesn't get left holding that tension or holding that fear, holding that worry, where then Bhagawan has to take over and just absorb it into the unconscious. You know, the defense system comes and says, okay, this is too much, we're going to take it away. And that's exactly what happens, but then it gets stored, that insecurity and fear gets stored in the unconscious and is often triggered, you know. And so the adult, the child and the adult going all the way through doesn't have that inner reserve of being wanted and being loved and being liked and being respected. And, you know, they expect people to like them. They expect people that people love them. They don't think, this person loves me and this person doesn't. They think, well, everybody loves me. They don't think about it. That's the thing. That inner structure is there. And so, you know, for most of us, even certainly in my generation, and I would guess all the way up to the present, it's been very, very difficult because of the various types of pressures, and you know what they are in your own countries. The countries vary some, but they're all Western countries, so at least I think in some of the European or northern countries like Sweden and Norway, and some, there's so many Bennies where if you have a child, I mean, Emma used to tell me how she and Jesper, how much time they spent with their child. They took the two of them took the first year off, and it was like a paid vacation to be with their child, you know. And so they got so much time. They were supported in being able to afford to give the child the amount of love and attention that it needs. And so if the child gets a good enough amount of that, then these kind of questions, the fear of not being liked or wanted, it's actually not a fear of not being liked. There's a feeling inside that I'm not loved, that I'm not liked. That is the feeling inside. And when somebody smiles at you or is kind to you or gives some attention, that feeling is assuaged. It's kind of overridden for the moment, only for the moment. And then when you're not getting the adequate amount of love and attention from the outside, then what happens is that underlying feeling rises its head again, because it's not, you may have fear of that feeling because you know that something can happen out here and that feeling of not being wanted will come up. But another way to language it is that is already there, that feeling. And so how to actually change that unconscious, that feeling that is almost structural there in the unconscious, rather than having the smiles and love of external people, you know, assuage it means kind of make it, soften it so much and make it as though disappear, and then we become dependent on these people to be nice to us or to show love and gratitude for us and all of these things to make us feel loved. And then, of course, we know, because the buddhi is very intelligent, all buddhis know, okay, that's temporary and it could change at any minute. So there's fear of going back into that complex. The complex is there. So that's why, as we kind of understand the inner workings of the unconscious, over time, a lot of this different forms of inner child work have come into being. because with the inner child work, we are assuming, or the knowledge assumes, that that child didn't get filled up when it was little. And so that complex is just residing there to be triggered by any amount of not being loved outside. You know, and I mean, that's a hard one because people aren't walking around loving you. To keep you nice and filled up by the outside, you know. And it's not even that they don't love you. They're just not thinking about you. They're thinking about themselves and themselves getting filled up. You know. So that's why we've found that, and not we found it, actually goes back centuries and centuries and centuries. There's a wonderful book called, if you're interested, it's 1,000 pages long. It's called The Discovery of the Unconscious. It's really well written, especially if you read the first half of it, that goes way back into antiquity and shows how the level of consciousness and ways to work with the unconscious. So it's, in a way, in many ways, we're reinventing the wheel, you know, it's our understanding and just framing it within a more modern context. But this inner child work recognizes that there's this this is a kind of the complex or the hurt of our time. It's not feeling loved or wanted or held in any type of esteem or respect or anything. That's the, as Coet will say, that's the hurt of our time that we have to work on. And maybe the best way that we found is to, and let your buddhi, becoming that inner friend, that good mother. Some people have said, at least my clients and students have said, I don't know how to be an inner friend or how to find that inner friend. You don't have to find, I was telling you this yesterday, I think, talking about this, you don't have to find the inner friend inside. You find the person, that part of you, here and now, who has been a friend to people. You're a friend to... You're a friend to your friends, you're a friend to your colleagues, you're a friend to your plants, you're a friend to your animals. I mean, animals invoke beautiful, natural friendship. It's not very hard not to be a friend to your animal when they're sitting there smiling at you and waiting for you to come and play with them. It's just like a child smiling at you, your heart just opens. So you know how, you know, so many times when you've been a friend, you know. I think we have to turn this heater off, can we? I'm starting to really overheat. Good heater. Thank you.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, good, thanks. So anyway, we've learned that we can, when we have that feeling, instead of trying to satisfy it externally, we can go to the feeling itself. And that feeling itself is something that with Bhagavan's defense system that's been given to us, it's part of the creation that we have, the upadhis have. It takes those feelings of hurt in the childhood, at time of childhood, where you have no way to even know what to do with that or how to solve it. So the defense system swallows it, swallows the entire affect, the hurt affect, it swallows the situation which caused that, the dyad, you know, the couple, you, the little child and whoever else was involved to kind of, to create that situation. It just takes the whole thing and swallows it and then locks the door so that you don't have to deal with it at all. For you, it won't even exist. You know that just to kind of talk about this a little bit, it's like, say if there was, it doesn't have to be severe, but say it was kind of a severe neglect or abuse or something. That can be swallowed. You have no memory of it at all. It's not there. And then what can happen is as you grow up, you know, there can be some discomfort inside because there's pressure of this. In that reading I did of Swamiji, he said this so nicely. There's something that wants to come out, but you don't know what it is, and you don't even know how to get there, you know. And so you want to do that kind of inner world, child work, but nothing is really happening. That's one thing. There's just the wall. I'm not ready. You know, the defense system says no. You cannot get in there. It's not good for you at this time. Don't ask. You can be very strong like that. Another thing that happens that is really interesting is that without the situation, the causal situation of that pain coming up, no causal situation, but the pain keeps coming up. And when that happens, that's usually because there's something out here that triggers it. Raising, a Swamiji will just kind of jokingly say, like the raising of an eyebrow, you know. How do you know what that person probably wasn't even thinking about you and your eyebrow raises, but you saw it. And somehow there's a connection between that trigger and that pain in the unconscious. And that causes it to come out and project onto that person or on whatever the trigger was. Just like that, it will come. But you have no idea, or even probably until you begin gain some psychological knowledge, you only think it's out there. That person did this and that, and I'm hurt, and I'm angry, and I'm frustrated because of what they did. That's as far as it goes. And then you kind of act out toward that person and whatever, but it's all existing out here. That's also kind of another safety. It's like a safety valve, you know, for that Bhagawan gave us for the unconscious, because that, as far as the defense system knows, we are still doing our job, you know. We are still keeping this event, this hurt, protected. And so it wants to come out, so let's just have a projection. Give it a little relief. It's like a, you know, in a pressure cooker. Psh! Okay, but as we start to really understand what's going on, you can notice that there is, can be a split. For instance, the pain comes out and projects, but we have no idea about the situation. So it's that safety valve. The problem has landed outside, and then we're reacting to it. It's all out here. We have no idea or even thought about what actually happened. We don't know about the projection part, and we also can't relate the pain that I'm feeling to the event that caused it. So there's like a split. Now, it can go the other way, too. You can have a memory. This is so, it's just interesting. This is all, you have to think of it as Ishwara. Nobody can come up with all of this. It's just an infinite intelligence and protection and love, actually. You know, so you just won't, that's it. Yeah. So what can happen is you can actually remember very clearly what happened. You know, like, I'll give it some gruesome example would be when I was not, this isn't from me, this, I'm just making this up. Say you're in your family, where maybe an uncle or a grandfather or somebody was actually highly abusive. Maybe even, you know, sexually abusive to maybe his children and then to his children's children. There's actually many situations like this, very intense situation. And so as a therapist, I can have a patient, a client, who tells me the whole story without any feeling at all, even though she also was one of the abused people. I mean, but they have memory, but they only have memory of the event, not memory of the emotions that were associated with that event. It's just like talking about, oh, I watched TV the other night, and it was this very unusual story where this grandfather had abused all of his children, and then he would babysit their children, and they were also abused. And just tell me like a movie or something, you know. No feelings, nothing. That's that split. So this can happen, remembering the whole thing with totally dissociated from your feelings, or having only the feelings totally dissociated from the memory. That's one of the ways the defense system is protecting you, right? And so when we do this inner work, going into like this, and I say like this, say we have the memory of the feelings. We have access to the feelings, but not to the event. Okay. When we can say that, when in your day-to-day life, your emotional reaction to a person or to a situation is quite intense, or if you look objectively, you might say it's a little bit bigger than is deserved by the situation. You know, actually that should be very handleable, but instead you're deeply wounded. Jung, Carl Jung, talks about that as a signal that if that's what's happening, then there's something in your unconscious that has been triggered that brings out a much bigger emotion than what would normally be required. And you can feel that, you know. Once you're kind of in a space, or somehow you've come into some psychological understandings, or you want to work on yourself psychologically, then you can, because you know there's some issues in there, that there's too much hurt, there's too much, you know, too much hurt, you know. Then you want to do this work, and that in the Jungian world is a real trigger. And so what you do is, when that emotion arises that's a little bigger than it should be, instead of acting out on it, you know, the first thing to do is to really just be by yourself and be with that emotion and kind of follow it down, you know, just embrace it and follow it down and talk to it, you know. And that's an entry into inner child work, because the emotion itself was most likely captured before your psyche could handle it, right? If the psyche is unable to handle it, you know, the conscious mind is unable to handle it, the defense system takes over. That is exactly its job. It takes over and it sequesters it so you don't have any memory of it. And so now, as we want to work on ourselves, we can use our own feelings that rise up, especially if they overwhelm us, as kind of what Freud will call the royal road to the unconscious. That he uses dreams for that, and Jung does too. Dreams, the royal road to the unconscious, but also your feelings as the royal road to the unconscious. Because the feelings are here, they're triggered, and so they seemingly belong out here to this situation. But once you have more understanding, you suspect that there's something else bigger inside. And so then you sit with that feeling, invoking the inner friend. If you don't invoke that inner friend, and by inner friend, I said in a minute ago, it's the, you know, you've been a friend to people, you know what that is, so invoking that part of yourself. But now to talk about it in reference to that feeling, your unconscious, if you go in as a grumpy, critical person, you know, the defense system just goes, we're not letting that person in. Nope. And so you just hit kind of it shuts down on you because you're a threatening force, you know. You can't be a threatening force and think that your defense system, which is protecting that thing, you can't expect it to open up. You can't expect it to open up immediately, too, if it's a big deal inside. It has to trust. It has to know that the one who's coming to be with it is a good enough mother or a good enough father that cares. That there's a number of things you can say about this. It's all, to me, it's all dharma, that whoever is sequestered there inside, that part of yourself, it needs to feel trust, it needs to feel loved, needs to feel wanted, it needs to feel respected, it needs to feel liked, that you want to be with it, and it needs to feel that you want to help, not hurt. I could go on, right? You could go on too. What do you think that little one inside would need to feel about you in order to let you come into relationship with it? Basically, I just say inner friend. If we talk about the inner friend even a little bit more, really, the inner friend is your buddhi that has the self, the unimpeded self as its self. rather than the buddhi that has some unconscious critical voices inside, you know, or some an irritable presence that it's interjected and walking around as the buddhi, but also the inner voice is critical critical is a good word. It kind of takes care of a lot of things. Critical, suspicious, not giving you the benefit of the doubt, is that it doesn't respect you or think that you're good enough. You're not good enough. You know, you're not worthy of my respect. I don't trust you. So you can have parents that have, you know, things like this. And who wants to be with those parents? But then you interject their voice. And so now you have this buddhi that has these unconscious voices coming in, and they're the very voices that you grew up with from childhood, because it's not usually the parents are just what they are, you know, unless they go to therapy or something. They can be just what they are for the time that you're born till the time that you leave the home, unless they've worked on themselves, you know. It's not like their unconscious changes. It doesn't. It's locked in. It doesn't change. It just projects, you know. So unless they've gone in and done some real work to bring these things to consciousness, they just basically stay as they are. And so what happens is that your buddhi, your antakarna, your mind, continues to talk to you in this way. Talk to you means what? These are the type of voices that if you do something, say you make a mistake, or you don't get an A, or you don't do something perfectly, this voice will say, oh my God, you're so stupid, you know, or some awful thing like that. So you don't need these terrible people out here. They're all in there talking away. And so in such a situation, one thing in psychology that we ask everybody to do, and all of us, you know, this comes up in different ways for when we're doing this type of work, to listen to how your mind talks to itself. Because since it's been doing it from infancy, you may not even hear it. You may not even hear that critical voice. Or if you do, you just simply take it for granted, you know, because it's always been that way. You know? One person that I knew was... This is doesn't about the mind. This is about her own body, because of some allergies and things that she didn't know that she had. She thought, as a little girl, that it was normal to have a stomach ache after eating, because she always had a stomach ache after eating, you know. And so that's part of eating. So she didn't like eating very much because she always felt sick after eating and had to go lie down and didn't feel good, you know. This went on for years until it was finally, she said something that brought it to light for her parents. Like, what? What? Of course, she never said anything because she never experienced it any differently. Eating means that your stomach cramps up and you don't feel good, you know? So we're kind of like that, you know? It's like these voices are going on, these critical voices or whatever. And you just are beaten down by it, but you don't realize that it could be any other way. You don't even notice it. It's just part of the environment of the psyche, the environment of your conscious mind. But if you can, once you recognize that, you can realize that your own interior space, there's no inner friend there. And so, you know, like in the world, here in the world with your sangha, but then you have your families, and you have your friends, and you have your workplace. There's all of these different kinds of people that are part of your life. And say there's just even one person who really doesn't like you, doesn't have any respect for you. There's just you irritate them. Okay, so say it's at the workplace. There's a person, I had that once. It was really awful. So say there's a person in the workplace that you have to deal with, mostly on a daily basis, but for whatever reason, they have a really hard time with you. And so now, how do you feel about going to work when you have to deal with this person, you know, who has some problems, some hostility there? I would say basically you really don't want to go. it's not at all where I would want to spend my time. So that's kind of obvious that in this external world, you want to have a place, you know, where you feel wanted and loved and respected. Just an aside, I've noticed this in my workplace when I go to work at the school where I teach, and we're hiring people, like right now we're hiring. You know what? We have all kinds of qualified, not all kinds, but it's hard to get qualified people for the particular program that we're in. But there's a lot of people who will apply, and it is true that to take them, they do have to be able to teach the type of courses that we need and all of that. But you know what is fundamental for us is whether we feel that they fit in with our group to make our group enjoyable make it enjoyable for us to be together. Mm-hmm. And so say that person adds to that, you know, feeling of home, like we're going to a nice home, our home. Then they are going to be given lots of benefit of the doubts. I've noticed that continually, and I'm exactly the same way. I want whoever we hire to be somebody that I'm happy to go to work and see. You know, not somebody who I think, oh no. Yeah. So now I'm just saying that example because what about in your internally? Do you want to be home? Do you want to be home in your own mind? Because all of the different parts, you know, it's like Freud's superego is that voice, that the voices, the internal voices that you have, the commentators, you know, or commentator, is someone you love to be home because of them, because of how they care about you, how they give you the benefit of the doubt, how they want to help, you know. Then there's Shanti, a deep Shanti inside, because if that is kind of the nature of this inner voice, that will also be the nature of the one that does this inner work also, and those little ones will also be happy. Because somebody who loves me and thinks I'm good enough and has respect for me, that respect is very important, you know, respects me, is coming to see me and help me, you know. All they want to do is help. That's how I used to feel that way always about Swamiji. I'm sure I've interjected him in many, many ways because I would always feel, you know, that he loved me and really loved me and really only wanted to help and see what my needs were and how could he help. That's all he ever had in his mind. He never had any kind of criticism. It wasn't at all about criticism. It was about helping me to grow, you know. And so I had so much trust in him. But we want that. It's wonderful to have that coming from the outside, but we also need to carry it from the inside, right? So that we don't have to go out and find somebody to give us that. And in fact, one beautiful thing about this knowledge, or having a teacher, or having an Ishta Devata, which is wonderful, or your relationship with Bhagavan, you actually get that. You get it internally, you can get it externally, you know, but especially internally, so that we discover that inner friend inside, and it's that inner friend that then is the supportive voice, the supportive attitude that allows you to have a happy inner home. It's really as it is outside, it's like that inside. And once we discover it, it's not so hard to do that. You just have to listen. It's quite simple, really. You listen, start listening, and hear what kind of voices are coming in. And then you say something like to that voice, we don't have to do that anymore. That's how your dad or mom or whatever used to always talk to you, you know. And so you're just, why you, one thing we say psychologically, why you get these inner voices is because of what we call anticipatory anxiety. It's because of the anger or the irritation of the, I'm using parents for now, it could be anybody who has that power role. You know that you're just anticipating, because you're a little child, you're anticipating getting yelled at, or being spoken to harshly or being criticized. And the child can't stand that, you know? And so it does it itself. You know, creates that voice. It does it itself because of anticipatory anxiety is worse than dealing with the reality here and now, which is true. Even for us, you know, if you're thinking about worrying about the future, there's this what we call anticipatory anxiety that creates a lot of tension inside. But when you're actually dealing with the future, which has become the present, it's much better, much easier. And so the child creates all kinds of anticipatory anxieties in order just to relieve the fear, you know, the fear of having to face that hostile voice. So we learn how to change that voice by simply recognizing and saying, talking to it, and say, you know, you've done your job. You've done a good job. We don't have to do it anymore because your father doesn't talk to you in that way anymore, never will again, and your mom doesn't scream at you and have a temper tantrum. That's gone. It's never going to happen. Never going to happen again. So you don't have to do this anymore. Now you can just be happy, you know. I love you. I will take care of you. You know, you don't have to worry at all. We don't have to have these voices anymore. And then if it comes up again, which it doesn't, it would come up very often, you just talk to it again. No, you don't have to do it. We can be really kind and nice and helpful. We can be exactly what you always wanted your parents to be. We can be that. That's how we're going to talk now. And it changes. They understand. It's the little ones inside, or the unconscious psyche, it's very smart. It's not stupid. You know, and it will respond and it will understand. If you explain, and if you or yourself are that inner friend, that you're yourself, you're kind, you're your own Swami, you know. You give that unconditional respect and love. Love, like, and respect. Swamiji once talked about, he talked about having a partner. Who would be a good partner? He was just reflecting on, who do you want to look for in a partner, you know? And so what he said was, you should love your partner, of course. You know, say you're thinking of getting married or something. You should love your partner. But that's not enough. You need to like your partner and respect your partner. And then that'll be a beautiful marriage. But say you love your partner, you're in love with them, or that's all a lot of projection there anyway. you love your partner, but you don't really like them. And you may love them and respect them, but you don't really like them, you know. Or the opposite, you love and like them, but you don't respect them. That's really bad. They're all bad. You have to have all three, you know. It's so important, you know. What if that respect isn't there? You know, that respect for that person as who they are, as a human being. You like that person. But it's more than that. It's more than just liking. You respect that person. And that those are the ingredients for according to Swamiji. But I've actually given a lot of thought. I've tried to improve upon it, I think. But I love that. I think it's really wonderful. So those qualities are not just for a person you fall in love with and end up marrying. It can be more generic than that. You just think about it. You know, you care about that person, you respect them, you like them, and then that's a good friendship, that's a good relationship. And it's also three words to make a little even more generic as a value, as your value system toward all living beings. They're just powerful words, you know, to try to invoke toward all living beings. Then you're like a Jagat Guru. I used to feel that about Swamiji because it didn't matter which country he was in. It didn't matter at all which country he was in, because he had that same deep connection with everybody, and everybody felt loved, wanted, liked, respected. It didn't matter where he was. That's a Jagat Guru. And it didn't matter, you know, who the person was. So that's that's your heart is as big as Ishwara. That's why so many of you have, at this point, you're growing, definitely growing in your knowledge and growing in your clarity, you know. And that will just continue. Actually, whether you continue listening or not, which I'm sure everybody will, and I would think that would be natural. But your unconscious has had so much knowledge and dumped into it over the last several years that it will go on working away at that, assimilating and assimilating. But really the best way, I would say, for those of you who are so inclined, is to teach it. You know? Because in the teaching of it, there's a couple of things that take place, is that you are invoking the Swami in you, you know, definitely. And also you're feeding that process of assimilation by giving it out. For those of you who have ever taught anything, like for me, the one in terms of worldly knowledge, that one of the best way that I learned Sanskrit, and all, a humongous amount of grammar in Sanskrit, but how I really learned it was when I taught it. Because otherwise it's all coming in, you're studying, but that process of giving it out, you know, makes a huge difference. Then you start to own it. This knowledge is the same way. You know, you're taking so much in, you can't even imagine how much is packed in there in your unconscious. And then when you start to give it out, then all of these things start to come together because the students are drawing it out of you. And so much becomes assimilated just because of the presence of some students who needs to know. It's like Bhagawan kind of takes care of it, you know. The student always comes to their teacher, whoever that's going to be at a given time. In terms of the Vedanta, we kind of respect that. And that means that those students will draw it out of the teacher, which helps the teacher, you know. And then they get themselves what the teacher needs. So there's a whole thing. When the teaching goes on, there's a whole thing that is going on that involves all of the students and the teacher, and there's just something that takes place based upon the needs of all in the class. So that willingness to teach and to just... There's certain pitfalls that I don't think any of us have. You don't try to teach what you don't know. You know, if you don't know something, you just have to say, I don't know. Sometimes it's not nice to always have to say you don't know, but it's much better than saying it. It's much better than doing the opposite. So you just have to not know. That's all. We're not Sarvajnas, you know. We don't have all knowledge. So there's going to be this going into these areas. I don't know anything about that. I've just learned to say, I don't know very much about that. I can give you, you know, maybe 5 minutes on it, and that's it. And anything over that, it's going to be something that I'm kind of making up. So you just have to, you don't have to be a guru. You're never a guru anyway. Nobody's ever a guru. It's your students see you as a guru because you're the one that has removed that ajnan. That's what a guru is. There's no guru walking around. No, I mean, honestly, we accept that in the tradition. The guru is only from the standpoint of the student toward the teacher, because that particular teacher is the one that removed that self-ignorance. That's what guru means, the one who removes the darkness of ignorance. That's what the meaning is. So you don't have to worry about being a guru or not a guru. You just have to be able to give this knowledge, you know, to be a good enough person, like a good enough mother, you know, and good enough to, and confident enough to handle this very sacred knowledge. You know, you have to be a good enough person. You have nishta, upayanishta, and upayanishta. You have nishta in the shastra itself. In this way, Swamiji talks about nishta now. That is your commitment. It's not just one of the things. That is what you're doing. That's your whole life is committed to that. No matter what you're doing in life, in your life, whatever your prarabdha is, or your life, you're married with kids, or you're single or your sannyasi. It's just your prarabdha. But in that prarabdha, you know, what is primary is this knowledge and the antakarana shuddhi, the upaya nishtha. So if I have a problem, I'm working on that. You know, that's what we do. That's nishtha. If you have a problem, if there's some unconscious thing being triggered or whatever, that's your test, and to work on that. That's nishtha. Nishtha in terms of the study, you know, that depth of understanding, that's my commitment to have the freedom that this knowledge brings. It's very, very simple and down to earth. If your mind is, you know, has too many issues, you know, you can still teach, but you have to be very open about your issues. You know, because what I think about when we talk like that is that Pranavananda, who taught Swamiji, you know, cranky is all get out, really. Really. Ornery, cranky, easily irritated guy, you know. He had work to do, but maybe he didn't want to do that work, who knows. But he was able to, he was just who he was, you know, and he had something to offer, you know. You have to see if poor students, they have to deal with all of that. You know? You have to have enough nishtha and clarity to not manipulate people. Yeah. Because we have a lot of charlatans out there in terms of their relationships with the students is self-serving and manipulative, and they will eventually go down, but they also cause a huge amount of damage to their students. So I don't feel in our Sangha we have that problem. The type of teaching is very different than that. You know, I don't think it leads to that, a level of narcissism. It doesn't lead, and it doesn't work for a narcissistic personality, that doesn't lead to that level of narcissism. It's the opposite, actually. So, back to that inner friend. Because Bhagawan has given us, you know, this defense system, he's also given us a way to, you know, keep everything at bay until I'm able to deal with it. But I am able to deal with it. And when that time comes, there's that inner child work, I think, and following the emotions, you know, as an inner friend is probably one of the deepest and best ways. Dream work is good also, but this is the most direct way. Making that inner friend with a primary voice, so that whenever you're home inside, it's a safe place, because of the way that your own psyche talks to you, with or without words. You're still coming into that safe place. And when you're coming into that safe place, then that inner friend or that buddhi that's really just a voice for the atma, a voice for yourself, the inner friend is not really different from your own being in terms of its affect. And you know, that one can go inside and follow those emotions and then ask, what happened? You know, what happened? Baris, I feel you're so hurt, you're so sad. You know? And then that can trigger memories at some point. Or you can, if it doesn't trigger memories, just the feelings, you can just raise that child in that imaginal realm of the unconscious by giving lots of love and lots of acknowledgement and lots of respect and seeing all the good things that little child does. Which is true, that we don't see that as, you know, because of the parent's own pain, tremendous pain. Because otherwise you're just, all you see is the most perfect little child in the world, you know, that is so beautiful, and everything she does or he does is so precious, you know. That's what's natural. If that's not happening, then there's some intense pain inside on the part of the parents, and work needs to be done. If the work isn't, they don't know how, or they don't have access to all of that, then the parents have to grow, the children have to grow up with that parent, that suffering parent. and that suffering manifests in many different ways. It can be very tough. Yeah. At least in this era, though, well, we'll see how things go. Hopefully, I know for all of us, we're all doing that work, and that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. That this type of work, this psychology, this that we're talking about right now, this is not unknown. This is, it's not just a few people know this in the psychology world, in the Jungian world, and all in all of the depth psychological worlds, or the psychologists are dealing with the unconscious. This is all common knowledge, you know. But it's the type of knowledge that is especially rewarding for us who are trying to gain this knowledge, and because that unconscious can act as, can obstruct us. It can obstruct the shanti in your mind, because it's as though underlying the shanti of your conscious mind is pressure underneath. You don't know what it is, but if you can have the experience that you're meditating, your mind's completely quiet and it's completely shallow. Nice quiet mind. I remember having that experience. I was taught how to meditate. I was about 18 or 19 or so. So I went into the bathroom and shut all the doors. It's the only quiet place. And because I was living with a bunch of young people like me. And so I sat in there and I did this mantra that I was given. And my mind was quiet. And I was just so bored. I did it maybe for 5 minutes, if that long. And then I just remember saying, now what? Sitting there in meditation, okay, now what? Because it was just quiet, shallow, a quiet, shallow mind. There was nothing. I didn't want to sit there with that quiet, boring mind. Because I had things that needed to be taken care of. And then when your mind is quiet, it is deep. It doesn't hit this wall of resistance, a wall of a defense system that says, no, you can't come in here. It's too loaded with things that you're not ready to see yet, not ready to feel yet. So you just stay out here on the conscious level. You cannot come in. And so then you have to slowly work on letting these things out one by one. And then when you close your eyes, it's beautiful. But until then, Bhagawan, in the form of the defense system, protects you. Yeah. So, Om Tat Sat for today. For this morning.
Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Hari Om.